This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's great to travel for the holidays, not necessarily so great to wait in crowded airports and stand on long security lines. And speaking of security, the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, is changing the security rules just in time for the holidays. My guest is Scott McCartney. He writes a column on air travel for the Wall Street Journal. It's called The Middle Seat. We're going to talk about recent and upcoming changes in air travel and the repercussions of this month's runway crash and air marshal shooting of a passenger. Scott McCartney, welcome back to Fresh Air. For anyone traveling over the holidays, how is the security check going to be different than what they're accustomed to?
Well, TSA is changing the rules right before Christmas. They are going to allow small scissors and somewhat innocuous items like that to go through security checkpoints. The theory is that that will speed up security screening, so lines in theory should be a little shorter. And they hope that the security will be more efficient because screeners can spend their time looking for guns and bombs and things that we really worry about.
I know a lot of flight attendants are concerned about the new security rules because they don't want 4-inch scissors on the plane, because they say that with a 4-inch scissors or with small hand tools, you can still hurt somebody pretty bad. So what have you been hearing from your contacts within the airline industry about the benefits and drawbacks of this new security plan?
Well, the airlines themselves are very much in favor of the new security plan. They want to reduce the frustration factor for their customers, and if you get rid of some of the hassle, more travelers will fly and travel on particularly on short haul routes where driving is an alternative is still down. The flight attendants are worried about their safety. It's a bit of a different issue now than the issue of hijacking an airplane and using it as a weapon. Most security experts will tell you that there's no way you can, with a 4-inch blade, hijack an airplane in the United States today. The cockpit doors are locked and reinforced. The procedures have changed. And frankly, the public has a different attitude towards it, as we saw on 9/11. With the United flight that crashed in Pennsylvania, customers won't tolerate it. So flight attendants are worried about the air rage incident than the hijacking. And I understand their concerns. The problem is there are many things that you could hurt somebody with on an airplane. You can still take glass bottles on an airplane or sharp pens or all kinds of things that can hurt people. So the hunt for 4-inch scissors or knitting needles or whatever it is doesn't take all the weapons out of the cabin, and it really does slow up security.
Why does everybody think that your personal computer is carrying a bomb? Why are personal computers treated differently than everything else?
It's a great question, and they're not treated differently in most of the rest of the world. If you travel in Europe or Canada, you won't have to take your laptop out of your bag. I think it goes back in many ways to the Lockerbie bombing of the Pan Am plane over Scotland, where a bomb was built into a boombox. And after that, the U.S. government has had great concern about electronics and saw laptop computers as sort of the perfect carrying case for some kind of bomb. The theory with the screening is that they want it screened by itself so that there aren't other articles on top of it or underneath it that would mask some kind of device or reduce the effectiveness of the X-ray.
Earlier this month, federal air marshals shot and killed a man who the marshals claimed said he had a bomb. He turned out not to have a bomb. What impact has this shooting had on the air marshal system?
You know, I don't think it's had much effect on the air marshal program itself. I think the government considers it a justifiable shooting, and the marshals acted appropriately. And, with any police shooting, there'll be a review and a separate agency. The Miami Police Department is actually investigating it. So, you know, I think we'll get an outside report on the whole incident. The interesting thing from a travel perspective is that the marshals were there in the first place. We don't quite really know how ubiquitous air marshals are. A good road warrior will tell you that you can usually spot them because they're wearing Hawaiian shirts and there's kind of a bulge around the belt where the gun is. Things like that, and sometimes you get bumped out of first-class cabin at the last minute because some guy in a Hawaiian shirt gets on the airplane. The interesting thing from air marshals are there to deter terrorists in the sense that they introduce that doubt that you want. They introduce the possibility that an air marshal is going to be on an airplane that you hijacked.
So do you think you've ever seen a marshal? Have you seen a Hawaiian shirt guy who bumped you from first class?
Well, I often ride in the middle seat, not first class. But I think I've seen some guys who, have... it's an interesting look. They're clean cut because they're federal law enforcement officials, and yet they're trying to look relaxed and casual. They're not the typical road warrior in the sense that they don't take out laptops and start working on spreadsheets. They're more apt to be reading a trashy novel or something like that. But if you really look at people closely and you see, that guy is studying the crowd very carefully. I wonder if he's a marshal. Oftentimes, that'll turn out to be the case.
Last week, a Southwest airline slid off a runway at Midway Airport in Chicago. It went through a fence at the end of the runway and then struck two cars on a road outside the airport, and a 6-year-old boy was killed. The problem apparently had more to do with the runway than the plane itself. So what was wrong with the runway, and what are... Well, yeah, let's start with that. What was wrong with the runway?
Well, the runway is a short runway, relatively speaking, 6,500 feet. Long runways at big hub airports are easily 10,000, 12,000 feet. Even at some smaller airports, you get 7,000, 8,000-foot runways as a matter of course. That runway is perfectly usable by that airplane, but you have to do everything right, and I think the investigators are looking hard to see if the pilots did something wrong, if the conditions on the runway, if there was braking conditions were poor on the end of the runway where the plane departed than back where it would have touched down. And so all those things can be a factor, as well as procedures at Southwest Airlines and things like that. This is the second Southwest plane that's run off a runway in the last couple of years. And so there will certainly be plenty of study of Southwest procedures and training and things like that.
Federal standards now require an extra 1,000 feet of overrun at both ends of a runway so that planes can skid without hitting anything. But apparently there's about 300 airports that don't fulfill that requirement. And they're not required to, in the sense that this new rule did not require retrofitting old runways. So are there affordable ways of making those now short runways longer?
There are. What you can do is there's now a material that's been approved by the federal government that is a mixture of foam and soft concrete, and it's shaped into blocks, and you put this pad at the end of a runway, and it's like flypaper. The plane goes into it, and it just stops. This has it's seen as the best solution for this problem, and this is a problem, as you said, at nearly 300 airports in the U.S. alone. This has been a concern for the National Transportation Safety Board going back to the 1970s. They've been urging airports to construct 1,000-foot overruns. The federal government has never required retrofitting that. But the FAA now, I believe just last year, approved this material called EMAS, and it's on 18 runways at 14 airports. There have already been three saves at John F. Kennedy Airport in New York where this prevented airplanes from going into the water. So it works. It's relatively cost-effective. It costs about $2 million to install it on a runway. And it can save lives. The airplane comes out relatively undamaged, and you don't have planes running into automobiles, which is a real problem.
why aren't more airports using this new mix of concrete and foam to extend their short runways?
Well, I think there's been some bureaucratic inertia on this issue, and there just hasn't been the sense of urgency. It can be a fairly tricky thing with the geography of the land. Sometimes you have to fill in ravines or creeks or things like that, and so you get into environmental issues. But it's, you know, a matter of cost and effort. And there just hasn't been a huge push to get this done. It gets installed at on runways where there has been an accident. Little Rock, Arkansas installed the EMAS soft concrete system after an American Airlines plane ran off the end of the runway. The same was true at JFK. Often in aviation, it takes an accident to force action.
My guest is Scott McCartney. He writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott McCartney. He writes for the Wall Street Journal. He writes a column called The Middle Seat. It's an air travel column. What tips do you have for people who are about to travel for the holidays?
Oh, I think security lines are going to be a big issue, especially if there's confusion about the security changes that we talked about. And the best tip there is that you don't have to go through the security line that's right in front of you. You can, in most airports, you can find an alternate security screening area. I have a friend in Dallas who goes to a little used terminal and parks and goes through screening there, and then rides the airport train to the busier terminal. You can, at some airports, simply walk down the concourse and find a shorter screening line. And the thing to do before you go off hunting shorter lines is to ask airport people, because you know they have to go through the screening lines from time to time, and they generally know that at 9 o'clock on Monday morning, Checkpoint 3 has a much shorter line than Checkpoint 2.
There are different ways to check in now. For some airlines, you could check in on the internet. There are kiosks where you could just, you know, put in your credit card or your frequent flyer card and check in through the kiosk. Or you could just, like, you know, wait on the regular line and check in that way. What do you recommend if you're in a hurry? What are the best ways of checking in now?
I think it's always a good idea to print your boarding pass out ahead of time if you can. One of the advantages of that is if the airline won't let you print your boarding pass, chances are you have been selected for extra security screening. That's generally when it comes up and says, oh, we're unable to print your boarding pass, you've been tagged as a selectee. So when that happens to me, I just make a point of getting to the airport a little bit earlier, and I'm sort of in a frame of mind where I know this is going to happen, and I just deal with it. I think as much automation you can use, the better, the faster it goes. You can check your bags yourself with kiosks at most airports and most airlines. And then, you know, you do your thing at the kiosk and your bag tag prints out, and all the airline employee has to do is essentially slap it on and check your ID. So that's much better than waiting in a long line or even paying a couple bucks to a SkyCap.
There's a new experimental system that some people are enrolling in that enables you to have a kind of a speed through privileges at the security line. Would you describe what that system is?
Yes, it's been a long time coming, and a very reluctant Transportation Security Administration is now, I think next year, going to finally roll it out to a much larger extent. An interesting name change. It used to be called Trusted Traveler, and now the government is calling it Registered Traveler. And I think there is it's more than symbolism there. The problem, the apprehension has always been we don't want to put people through without adequate security screening so that some kind of terrorism sleeper cell could take advantage of that trusted status. what happens is you pay a fee. There are private companies now involved in doing the screening, and you turn over to the government biometric information like fingerprints and I think retina scan, and all of your personal information, financial, employment, things like that. You get checked out and declared a registered traveler. And that gives you a card that at some airports, Orlando and a couple other test sites, you can essentially get to the front of the line with that card. The other thing it gets you is a promise that you won't be subjected to secondary screening. If you're a registered traveler, we're going to assume you don't need secondary screening. You do need the same primary screening that everybody else gets. So it does get you through faster, although I've heard complaints from travelers that you pay $75 and get to the front of the line, and if you know how to work the line system, that's not a huge benefit. But at the end of the day, you still have to go through the line. I think people originally had thought, "Hey, I'll get this card and I can just breeze through security," and that's not going to be the case.
Have you tried the system?
No, I haven't. We've had some colleagues who have tried, and I think there's a comfort factor here for people. It's very unsettling to some people when you get picked out for suspicion. And people who travel all the time or elderly or whoever say, well, why did you pick me? What was suspicious about me? And it may have simply been a random selection. There may be no particular reason or anything that you did wrong. But people find it intrusive and offensive, and so having a card in their pocket that says "I'm okay," that's going to be worth something to a lot of people.
On the other hand, I think it intrudes on people's comfort level to have to give that biometric information to the government and not know how it might be used in the future.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and plus all the personal information. If that's the trade-off for getting to the front of the line, and I do think there will be plenty of people who will say, "Hey, wait a minute, my privacy is not worth that, and the lines aren't as bad as they used to be, and I'm not going to worry about it."
Are there a lot of airports that can read your biometrics? Do they have the technology for you to actually take advantage of the system?
There are only a few, and we're in the test stage of the program. TSA says that in 2006 that they will begin rolling the program out, and they think that they can get the technology, the card readers, into airports fairly quickly. Airports have told them that they can do that, and so I think once they agree to do this program nationwide, it should roll out fairly quickly.
I'm going to use this interview as an opportunity to ask you a personal question about airline etiquette. When you are sitting in a seat, which is already uncomfortable, and the person in front of you has tried to increase their comfort by reclining to the maximum, and their seat is basically now in your lap, and it is making you incredibly uncomfortable, and it's hard to like eat or read or do much of anything because of their reclining chair. Is it a terrible, inappropriate infringement on their rights as an airline traveler to ask them politely to put their seat back in an upright position so that you could breathe?
No, I don't think it's an infringement at all, and I've done it myself a few times. I think if you do it politely and explain that I'm really trying to work and I can't open my laptop because your seat is now on top of my tray table, I think people are fairly understanding of that. Sometimes people say, well, the guy in front of me reclined his seat and we'll just kind of move up the aisle and say, if we could all sort of agree that, we'll only recline, just a little bit, everybody will be able to work and be perhaps a little more uncomfortable, but you're not going to be comfortable to begin with. I've also seen people ask flight attendants if they would ask the passenger, and that's kind of an interesting, I think, somewhat polite way of doing it. But I'm much more an advocate of asking nicely as opposed to, there was a wedge that somebody developed at one point to sell that would prevent somebody from reclining their seat and things like that, and I think that's borders on being obnoxious.
Are you traveling for the holidays or staying home?
Staying home this year.
Well, good for you.
Yes.
Happy holidays, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Great to be with you, Terry.
Scott McCartney writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.